They have all these dreams and they picture what they want to be, who they want to be, but they also know that they should know that it changes all the time. It's that that's the only constant. And I hope that through the conversations that we have, or you know, any other community have with Chinese medicine across the world, there'll be more students and practitioners sharing this sort of knowledge.
I'm Michael Max, and this is Cheological. Imposter syndrome is not listed in the DSM-5 as an actual psychological diagnosis. It's an idea from popular culture that masquerades as something that's true and real. I think it exists like writer's block exists, which is to say, it doesn't. There is no such thing as writer's block. There is only writing, and some writing is god-awful drivel that is a reflection of the junkyard of the confusion that's in our mind. There's no such thing as writer's block if you're willing to write utter garbage, which is actually a part of the process. It's that finger-wagging judgment at the beginning of the creative phase of the process that's actually the problem. We need a sense of expansive inclusion before we bring in the editor who can help to refine the work. But first, we need to do the work, which brings me back to the so-called imposter syndrome. There is no such thing, which is not to say that the feelings and the experiences that usually get swept into that rubric don't exist. They do. Anxiety is real, and for good reason, because whenever you show up, whenever you step up in front of other people, be it in person or online or in a book you write or even in your clinic, when you bring yourself genuinely into the clinical encounter, you could likely be a target. You'll be a target to those who don't have the courage to stand up and are often enough the first to launch their slings and arrows. Those who don't have the fortitude and the generosity to share what they have in public are usually the first to critique, complain, and find fault. Patients are looking for help, but some are ready with a bad Yelp review if you don't give them what they think they want. If you're up in front of others and you feel nervous, you should, because it's often not friendly territory. Experiencing a lack of confidence is not something that's wrong with you. It comes with the territory of beginning. I'm more worried about people who lack experience and yet present as confident. When beginning any endeavor, you hopefully have enough training and experience to have a modicum of competence. But confidence? Well, that comes from the fiery tempering of failure, confusion, random moments of grace, and the gradual accumulation of experience. Social anxiety is real. Most of us have it to one degree or another. We should. We are social creatures, and if unsure of our position or unsure of the ground we stand on, we'll feel uncomfortable. That's not a problem, and it's not a diagnosis. That is figuring out who we are within the social milieu we find ourselves in. Not to mention what I already had to say about anyone who stands up, anyone who dares to stand out, you're asking for the dark shadow side of those who don't have your courage to bring out their fears in the form of criticism, demeaning, and even hatred. It's not imposter syndrome that makes us feel uncomfortable. It's the very real hatred and jealousy of others who enjoy criticizing what appears to be authority. If you have self-doubt, if you set high goals or recognize areas where you could improve your work, then you're actually a step ahead. You're a step ahead because you're less likely to fall into hubris, more likely to avoid complacency, and if you know where your skills are weak, then you have a roadmap for making them better. Sometimes the thing we think is wrong with us is actually the thing that's right about us. Those who excel know when they don't know. And yes, that can leave you feeling vulnerable, but it also keeps you open, inquiring, and engaged. Like I said earlier, there's no such thing as writer's block. Writers write. They often write garbage. That's part of the process. And I'm not buying into the idea of imposter syndrome. Putting your work out in front of others is nerve-wracking, especially if you know your material is a work in progress, and most of our work is. Especially if you have a sense of empathy It takes some courage and the strength of being on friendly terms with your vulnerability. I heard a wise man once say that we are well served if we can cultivate a sense of equanimity so that we are equally unmoved by both the cheers and the jeers of others. Then we can get down to the work of creating and sharing what we have to offer with others. You're not an imposter if you feel uncertainty. You're human. It's what you do with that uncertainty and how you navigate it that makes all the difference. In a moment, we're going to sit down with the guest of show number 200, Denise Hung, and discuss learning, mentorship, and how the world of Chinese medicine looks through the eyes of a student. You've heard me say more than once how surprised I've been that so many students listen to the podcast and find it helpful. One of the delightful things about the creative process is you don't know where it's going to take you, which seemingly promising avenues are actually dead ends, and what expected opportunities just might arise. In the next few weeks, I'll be sharing with you some changes coming to the podcast. Chiological has been an opportunity for me to curate East Asian medicine and methods through the power of conversation and to connect the voices of our community. And it's been an opportunity to work with some different business models so as to create a sustainable enterprise so that this library of conversations can be available to you whenever you want to listen. I'll have more to say about that in the next few weeks, along with some news about expansion of the content here within the podcast. I'm excited about the changes coming up, and I hope that you'll enjoy what we have in store for you. As ever, a deep bow of gratitude to everybody who has helped Chiological to grow to this point. Without the generosity of the 200 people who have said yes to a conversation here, without the sponsors who have helped to support the show, and all of you Chiologicians who helped to keep gas in the tank here, there wouldn't be a Chiological. And, of course, without you, the listener, there would be no point in sitting down at this microphone every week. Now, let's get into this conversation with one of the new generations of upcoming practitioners. Denise Wong, hello. Welcome to Chiological.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me here.
So happy to have you here. This is episode number 200. Unbelievable. Episode number 200. And you raised your hand and said, I'd like to come on to the podcast.
Yes.
Here you are.
Thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you. Whatever inspired you to raise your hand and say, I want to do this?
Well, I had a lot of questions about where traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture can go with the current world and society right now. And within our sphere, I want to talk more about how practitioners can be mentors and how we as students can look through the eyes of practitioners.
Mm. Okay. Well, we can do all of that. I would like to begin with something that you just said. You were just saying that our medicine, you're curious about like where it is, more importantly, where it's going, where it might go. I would love to first hear your thoughts on that. What you see, you're brand new. In fact, you're in the midst of school. Where do you see this going? What does the future look like to you from where you stand at this moment in time?
I'm currently in Melbourne, Australia. So traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture, it's a big industry here with integrative health. And a lot of people are turning to acupuncture and Chinese herbs for treatments. So it's really positive. I see a lot of people opening their eyes and being very open-minded to, you know, getting treatments. It used to be, I believe, a lot more close-minded. People were a bit more skeptical. But now everyone's really, really happy and looking for practitioners. So I see a future with us within the medical field, definitely. But also I question where and how it goes with acupuncturists and Chinese medicine, whether we use raw herbs or granules, you know, what techniques we use and what should we use, the nitty-gritty stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like in this modern integrative world that you're embedded in there in Melbourne, it sounds like it's a very forward-thinking place, that there's ways our medicine would not be able to flourish?
I think the only side is probably the misconceptions and misuse, perhaps, because a lot of people still don't understand what's acupuncture. There's a lot of misunderstandings still, and we're constantly out there, as we are now, talking about Chinese medicine and educating the larger society.
So when you talk about integrative use of the medicine, what does that look like over there? I hear that term a lot here in the United States as well, integrative medicine, but I think it means different things to different people in different places. I'm wondering what the landscape is that you're seeing.
Yeah, so right now within our student clinic, we have naturopath, myotherapy, Chinese medicine. So you can go to a naturopath and get consultations, but you can come for acupuncture as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think nowadays the allied health services, you can talk among the naturopaths and the myo and Chinese medicine and see how can we work together to better this patient. So that's really interesting and fascinating for me, because you're not only learning about Chinese medicine, but you're also learning the Western medicine. And that's being very forward, like mm-hmm. trying to integrate both sides. I believe the other part of the world is also doing the same thing. It's just not that we don't know about it or don't hear about it as much. But as students, we do get research papers and journals that we read about how to integrate it both sides.
So are you having to learn something about naturopathic medicine or conventional medicine as well as your Chinese medicine?
Very interesting you asked that. I actually started out as a naturopath student.
Wait, you are a naturopath student?
I did start as a naturopath student before, and then I changed to Chinese medicine.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I did study about a year and a half to 2 years from that perspective. And then I was in the student clinic for acupuncture so often that someone said to me, I think you really need to think about where you want to go with your career. I just found it a lot more effective for my body and my shin. Yeah.
So you had a year and a half in naturopathic education, and then you mm-hmm. switched horses. You changed teams.
I did. And now I guess the naturopath lecturers look at me and be like, I don't recognize you anymore.
Uh-huh. So what was it about Chinese medicine, other than your bodily embodied experience, that this stuff is different? Was there anything else that made you think, ooh, this is the road for me?
Really interestingly you asked that, because I'm from Malaysia, but I've never grew up using acupuncture. I've used herbs,
mm-hmm.
but my family was not very open to acupuncture for some reason.
But they were open to herbs.
They were very open to herbs.
But not acupuncture.
Open. Yes. Very interesting. I'm not sure why. I should ask my parents why about that. So they were not very open about that. We were very open to herbs because it was just in our daily lives. The dietary plans and, I mean, like everything. I remember I had shingles as a kid, and the herbs helped me more than any antibiotics and things like that. So it just went away. And when I got to Melbourne, I tried acupuncture for the first time ever in my life. And I remember stepping out of the clinic, feeling a bit like, oh, this is so good. And the next day I woke up and like, what happened there?
Mm-hmm.
And I just got hooked.
I can remember my first acupuncture treatment as well. And I look back on it, I could reliably say it actually changed my life. Now, it's not necessarily that in that moment it was like, oh my God, everything's different, but it like slightly changed the trajectory of how life went. You know, just a little course correction, just a little course correction. And over a period of time, that can take you to a very different place. But same sort of thing. I came out of that treatment thinking, what was that?
Yeah. And you go back and you go back again mm-hmm. and again. And then you realize, wow, this really is changing something. It's into small little steps.
So what we're talking about, the way that acupuncture works, because I think for a lot of people, this really is the way that it works. It's a slow, moment by moment, step by step, you realize, oh, I'm walking a different path now. Now, there are people who have an experience with acupuncture, one or two treatments, their life is dramatically different. You know, we all like those fantastic success stories where you just completely knock it out of the park and the patient is really wowed by it. And I think acupuncture is famous for being kind of magical that way because it does happen from time to time. But more often, I think it is this slow. It's like if you make a really good stew. You can't make a really good stew in 2 hours. You've got to let that thing cook overnight. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, for sure. But people just love instant gratification, don't you think? I just want that.
I think we do. I totally count myself in that number. I think that medicine also makes an implicit promise that we're going to help you ideally without too much of your own involvement in getting helped. And acupuncture is a little bit different. It's more like we grow more into who we are. And in some ways it's a DIY project. You have to like do it yourself. You have help with it from your practitioner, but it's something that we actually do from within. And I think that by and large, at least my understanding of conventional medicine here in the West, I don't know how it is there in Australia, is that we're going to do this for you or we're going to do this to you.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty much the same. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, in student clinic right now, I have patients asking me, so how long would this take?
Right. And they're not going to come back if you say the rest of your life.
Yeah, and I have patients who, you know, changed their dietary plans in a week, and they come back the next week, and they're like, "I'm like, your pulse is different. Your tongue is absolutely different." And that's within a week. I just gave you a couple of advice to take one or two things out from your meal and just change one or two things, and then you're doing the work. I'm just giving you the tools.
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah. So how far along are you in your training right now?
I graduate next year, hopefully, end of next year. Because of the situation that we're in right now, clinic hasn't been able to run for a couple of trimesters that we're in, just because there's just too many people inside.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, face-to-face has changed quite a bit as well.
Okay. And you wanted to talk about mentorship and learning.
Yes, I did.
All right. So tell me more.
We have to do a certain numbers of internship and externships. I'm not sure if you understand that terminology. Mm-hmm.
I do. When I was in school, the school that I went to, at least at that time, encouraged us to find some externships to take a look at methods we're interested in or they might not be teaching, but to get out there and meet other people, do some learning on your own. So that's externships are a great idea.
Yes, I do love externship. That's where I met like some of the best practitioners, and some of them I go, I'm not sure if I want to practice this way. And through my experience of meeting those practitioners, I question what makes a good mentor or a practitioner as a teacher. you know, how can you hold space and allow students to come in or allow the patient to feel comfortable at the same time? I mean, it's not easy to have two or three more people in the room where if a patient is so used to seeing just one doctor and sharing all the information, and then you have a student there sitting at a corner and you're like, oh, I'm not sure if I want that student to listen. So would they stop sharing what they should share? But we get amazing patients who are, you know, so welcoming, and they allow you to feel the pulse and look at the tongue at the same time, and then get to know you a little bit more. And you just get to learn so much more about a patient and the case as well, and it helps your learning journey. But at the same time, I see students getting into the field and the externships and, you know, seeing practitioners, and then they go, oh, not quite sure, don't really want to be there anymore. And I ask myself, is it because you had a bad experience with that practitioner? Do you want to look for a different one that resonates with you a little bit more because of your cultural background, you know, your beliefs as well? I mean, everyone's so different practicing.
What are some of the complaints that you're, I don't know if complaints is the right word, but what are some of the things that you're hearing from the people who say, yeah, I don't know if I want to be with this person learning?
I think it's probably personality sometimes. It gets really hectic in the clinic sometimes. And, you know, sometimes practitioners don't have time to explain to you what's going on inside the room. They just show you or get onto it, and then they're not as welcoming, or they're very rude, or sometimes they just, I don't know, they just don't connect.
They just don't connect.
They just don't connect. And then sometimes some clinics are run like a business. And I question.
Well, of course, it is a business. Of course they're run as a business. Clinics are a business.
But it's run more like a corporate business, like really corporate. And a lot of, it's really interesting. So Chinese medicine is a field where I believe it's not your first degree. It's not your first port of call for as a career. So this is a second career for a lot of students. And a lot of them are from a corporate background, and they often don't want to go back to that.
Wait a minute. You said, a corporate background.
Yes.
So they're run. Yes. So the clinics are run like corporations.
Yes, they run like corporations. So the hierarchy, the system, and the fast-paced environment. But we all know that that doesn't lead to a holistic space where it's, you know, call for a good healing environment.
Are you sure about that? No, seriously, are you sure about that? How do you know that?
I think to a certain degree, it works for certain patients within a certain demographic. It definitely is, because everyone's just in a really fast-paced society right now. You know, everyone just want to go, go, go. They're hustling. But at the same time, I see those that thrive, and I question those that don't thrive as well. I understand where that's coming from. And I see, that's where I see students going, oh, I'm not quite sure. But places like that, they do get a big traffic from patients, because patients don't see what's going on inside. But the turnover for students and interns are very high. So I see that, because the point of a mentorship for me personally, it's you find someone, you resonate with them, and you kind of stay with them, and you perhaps venture out on your own, but you still stay within that support. Those that don't mentor as well, I feel like they just have a big turnover of students. And because there's so many students out there, they just get so many coming in and then coming in and coming out. But behind, for the older students, there's always, I don't think they should go there anymore. Oh, you're there. Interesting. Good for you. Good luck. You know, we say things like that, but we don't often tell them the honest truth, because it's, we went through that ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So you used a word that I actually quite enjoy, and I use it a lot with my patients when we're talking about acupuncture, and that's the word resonance. And what I just heard you say was that some practitioners or mentors and students, they don't resonate. They're on very, very different wavelengths. Maybe a practitioner has a very busy 5 rooms. They're wearing roller skates to get between the rooms so they can get there quicker kind of practice. And their goal is to treat, 70 patients in a day. That's what they call a good day. And that's what they call a good business. That's what that practitioner calls a good Chinese medicine clinic. And there might be somebody else who would be happy to see 10 people a day.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a different kind of a clinic. So it sounds like in doing these externships and finding out what you like and what you don't like, or what you resonate with or what you don't resonate with, you find out perhaps what kind of practitioner you just might be on the road to becoming.
Yes, for sure. I think there is a different part of the world that practices Chinese medicine very differently as well. I know in Hong Kong or Southeast Asia, where they get a big support within a clinic. So there's dispensary, there's like maybe 4 to 5 people just dispensing, and then there's practitioners, and there's like many rooms, and there's people helping you with the bits and everything. So it's a huge support network. Where you can see, like you say, 70 people. But they kind of bring that model over here, and they realize that the model can work or can work, but they cut down on the support. So one person is doing like 3 jobs.
Why do you think that's the case?
I think just cultural or society that's different. I guess, like you say, it's a business as well. So the minimum wage is very different across the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's practically almost no minimum wage where I come from, whereas here, it's more regulated.
Right. So over in Asia, you could have 4 or 5 assistants helping you in your clinic. You might be spending what you'd be spending on one person in the West.
Yes.
In terms of help.
Yes.
Yeah. There's all kinds of cultural expectations as well. So I know that when I lived in Taiwan, for example, there was no such thing as an appointment to get acupuncture or herbs. Nobody had an appointment. You walked in and you gua hao, right? You go in, you take a number, wait in line and watch the karaoke show on TV. Right?
Yes.
Yes. That would never work here in the West.
Yeah. It's very different. You had to book an appointment. They ask you all these questions. You had to fill out consent forms.
Right. Consent forms.
Yeah.
There's a concept.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I never had to do that.
So how many clinics have you done an externship at, or you feel like you've had some kind of a mentor relationship with the practitioner?
I would say about 2 to 3. I've observed probably 5 to 6 clinics now. I have a few practitioners that really resonate and go like, I really want to learn from you more, a lot more. And I'm really thankful for them to open their doors and allow me in and share their knowledge and, pass this lineage on, this practice.
Mm-hmm. What would you say makes for an effective mentor? What are the qualities?
I think being a mentor it's really difficult, to be honest. The qualities is almost really motherly in a way. You're nurturing. You're also allowing space for mistakes, questioning, encouragement. Yeah, but you also want to put them or put students in a slightly uncomfortable spot and go, think about that. Look at a bigger picture. What are you seeing? What are you not seeing? But at the same time, as a mentor, you also go, oh, that's interesting. Well, I haven't learned that in a while. I've been to a clinic and a practitioner and go, oh, yeah, I really forgot about all that. Because if you're so used to doing what you do, I mean, a practitioner can be so used to seeing just gynecology patients. But if you have a musculoskeletal patient and you go like, oh, wow, I haven't done that in a long time. You know, as students, you just learn everything. You have all this knowledge.
Well, are you actually learning everything? Or is it that you're being exposed to a wide spectrum? I mean, it takes time to learn this stuff. Well, it is. I mean, it is a lifelong journey, you know, and we like to say that. These days when I hear the word lifelong journey, I think, oh, God, that's a long time. I don't know if I want to do that. I want to feel like whatever I'm undertaking, that I'm going to have some sense of competence within a reasonable time frame so that the juice is worth the squeeze.
Yes, for sure. The other qualities that I see with a mentor is also to help students understand the texts, you know, traditional Chinese medicine. Because it's like having the texts and then having the teacher and then having the student. But if you don't have the mentor or the teacher or the practitioner who understand the text just doesn't come to life. And it's just really like a music score without the music.
I've heard, this has not been my experience, but I have heard that traditionally, and traditionally means, I don't know, 50, 100 years ago, I don't know, whatever they mean by traditional. These are stories I've heard from other people. This is not my experience. That when people would go to learn medicine previously, the teachers would give them a book and ask them to read the book. And then eventually they would explain the book, but it could be a long time before they got around to explaining the book. It was a much longer process of learning and acquisition of experience and knowledge. I mean, these days, in some ways, it's great having schools because we get it faster. And in a traditional apprenticeship, it could take you, I don't know, maybe a decade to get what you're getting in a few years.
Yeah, we're very fortunate to have all the support from practitioners. And, you know, I learned so much just by listening to you. Listen to you and your conversations with other practitioners as well.
One of the things that it seems to me is that Chinese medicine, I'm just roughly using that term, Chinese medicine, is indeed learned through dialogue. It's learned through having experience and talking about it with other people to try to suss out what things mean. It happens in between a patient and a practitioner, right? There's all that dialogue of someone comes in with their experience and the practitioner has to be able to take that, parse it out. What does that mean from a Chinese medicine point of view? And then be able to communicate back to the patient with a language that ideally is not Chinese medicine because they don't know Chinese medicine. They're not here to learn Chinese medicine. They're just here to feel better, right? It's very tricky speaking it back to somebody. The dialogue seems really important.
The dialogue is very important.
Do you find that reading the older books is helpful to you? And if so, in what way?
The older books are very helpful because for some, I guess, practitioners, I can't meet them anymore. They're just not around. One of the books I really, really find really daringly currently is The Applied Channel Theory. Have you read that book before?
I'm sorry, which one is it?
The Applied Channel Theory.
Dr. Wang Shuyi.
Yeah.
Wang Shuyi, yes, yes. Fantastic material.
It's fantastic. And right now, I'm actually using that book as my guide. He is my practitioner who's teaching me, even though he's not around anymore. And I connected with Jonathan just over Facebook, because they have podcasts and they have a Facebook group, you know, and I go into the practice room in the student clinic. And then when I palpate my patients, I go, huh, what would Dr. Wang say right now? You know, and I connected to Jonathan and then found another practitioner who learned from Dr. Wang himself here. So I think that's that lineage and in understanding where you can ask and you really read more. And I guess one of the best ones is also Stephen Covey. And you know, his books are amazing. We're very fortunate to be here to learning from him. Yeah.
I just recently got my copy of the third edition of Fluid Physiology and Pathology, and I read it when I was a student, and I'm rereading it again in the new Eastland Press version. I think of that book as the classic of fluids. Jing ya jing.
Yeah, it's so good. Plus the lantern as well.
Yo, yeah.
Yeah. So Bettina is actually my lecturer.
Lucky you. And have you had any business classes from Auntie Babak by any chance?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you should really check Auntie out. He's got some very good business advice there.
Yeah, that'd be really good. But I think that's probably towards the end of our course before we exit.
I want to come back to this mentor piece. Because so much of the medicine does get passed down from person to person. At the same time, so much of the medicine gets passed down, as you're learning Dr. Wang Jui's methods, because you're reading his book. Jason Robertson did an incredible job with that book, you know, in taking the experience that he had with Dr. Wang back in the early part of the century, living in Beijing. And so we can get a lot of it, good information, and we can get experience. Well, we can't get experience, but we can get, let's just say, some pointers toward acquiring experience from the books, right? And we can get that from something as recent as Dr. Wang's book or as ancient as the Suwen in the Nei Ching. But it's up to us to make it real. It's up to us to take it and find out how does this unfold in our experience. And certainly working with a mentor, certainly working in a clinic where you can see it unfold in real time and you can have the kind of eyes and ears and senses of somebody who's been at it for a while is useful, right? So it's very easy to look at like, oh, there's a mentor and that's a good mentor. I should get me one of those mentors. But I'd like to flip this around for a moment and say and ask you this question, which is you as a student, you as a, let's say, beginning practitioner, because you are, what do you have to offer a mentor?
I guess like what I say just now, you know, having that pair of eyes where they've been practicing for so long. And, you know, they've been so used to doing the same things. Whereas we come in as students and we go, huh, we're actually taught this way in university right now. Is there a reason why you're not doing that? Is there a reason why you're choosing this method instead? So it's kind of putting them in the spot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've asked that a couple of times before, and they try to explain to me why they teach that in school and why is this method used in this clinic and why they choose that.
So in some ways, you get to help them keep their own mind a bit fresh by asking them these questions, and then you're also getting to find out why you might learn something in school a certain way, but why it's practiced differently in actual clinical practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I remember teaching a class at one point on Dr. Huang's 10 key formula families, with, you know, the herbal methods of Dr. Huang. And it was at a school, and I remember prefacing my lecture with, if you're still a student and you haven't taken your test, I want to warn you, this stuff will not help you pass your test.
Hmm.
This is not going to be on your test. this thinking is different from what you will run into on your national exam. So you can use this in your clinic if you like, but like draw some kind of a divider between what you're learning in school for the test and how you would use these methods in clinic.
Yeah. And it's interesting, why would we choose both ends, and why would we not just use one? You
know? What are your thoughts about that?
I think it's through the experience, they probably don't see the same effects. They don't see the same results. Perhaps in their practice along the way, they gain different knowledge and methods as well. And patients react differently. I mean, in the text, it's so easy to say, patient react this way and that way. But when you actually come down to practice, patients are so different. Their bodies are so different. And I think through the experience, they will find what's more effective.
Experience definitely is helpful. And I suspect, too, that at least in the beginning, when you're learning pattern differentiation and you're learning to see, like, this is a liver pattern, this is a kidney pattern, this is a spleen pattern, that kind of thing, these are, in a way, they're like archetypes or abstracts of what you might see in clinic. It's very rare that you will see in clinic what is described in the book as the book is describing it. I don't know about you, every now and then I'll see somebody and I'll think to myself, I wish I had a student here. This is a classic textbook example of something. But that does not that actually doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, it doesn't. It really doesn't. I mean, it's like cooking, right? You look at a recipe and go like, oh, I really want to cook this because it looks like that. But when you actually cook the meal, it just doesn't look like the photograph anymore.
Well, sometimes they make food to look a certain way for the photograph.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's also that.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm really enjoying the whole, you know, externship and looking for a mentor out there. I guess learning from different mentors through our university experience, it doesn't stop. I think some students look for a few and then they just stop looking because they just get tired. It's a lot of work learning from another practitioner. It's, you know, going to university full time and then putting the extra work over the weekend. And on top of that, some students have actual work as well. And a lot of internships or externships, you don't get paid at all. You know, what as students will be offered is also helping to clean the rooms, perhaps part-time as a receptionist as well. That's all the experiences that we can learn and help out within the clinic. And I'm really thankful that some practitioners, they actually write a note out there and say, hey, a student is joining us, and this is the best way to learn Chinese medicine. Would you mind having them in the room? And it's just the language that they change instead of saying, oh, a student is joining us in the room, would you mind? But just by adding that phrase, it's the best way to learn Chinese medicine. A patient go, yeah, sure, come on in. I'll share with them my case and both of you can help me. Maybe you'd be more effective too.
Have you had any patients that didn't want you in the room?
Well, sure. Many patients. And I wouldn't want to be, I definitely don't want to be in a room when it's their initial consult because it's their first time. They might be a bit shy. But if they've been a regular, they'd be happy to do that.
What about you? Let's see, how do I phrase this question? Because you were just talking about you wouldn't want to be in the room for an initial consultation. Yeah, I'm curious to know more about your reticence for that. Why not be there? Why not be in from the beginning? What is it about your presence that you feel would be a problem?
I think they might be a bit shy sharing information because it's their first time meeting someone as a doctor or a practitioner. You know, they might not want to share for the very first time if someone else is there. But if they get comfortable, there's certain things they would share more and be honest about it. And I guess the presentation would be more obvious and helpful. And if I'm there, I feel like it'd be a hindrance in their healing journey for the first one, at least. Not sure if everyone share the same sentiment though.
I would invite you to reconsider that.
Yeah. I mean, I've been there for some initials as well. So I think it really depends on the person.
I think there's a couple factors here. One, obviously, is the person. I suspect the other is the presence that a student would bring to being in the room. It could be a fantastic opportunity to really practice listening, to really practice observation, to, you know, in a sense, be present but completely unobtrusive.
Yeah, I think that's very important. A lot of people don't know how to just be present. It's almost like meditating. It's just witnessing the ebb and flow. You're just there to witness.
What does that mean to witness?
Witnessing without interfering. So I think in a room where it's two people, they would just be, the eye contact would just be two people. But so often when there's a student there, the eye contact gets switched around. So the patient might look at you sometime when they're sharing the information and they want to get some affirmation. So you're just nodding, but not really saying anything. Just showing presence that you understand. And if a practitioner wants to say something, they look at the patient, but they also look at you. And just so that small eye contact, it changes as well the atmosphere in the room. And as a student, it's just really important to stay there and just witness and not ask anything. And it's really hard when you go, oh yeah, I understand how you feel, or you know, you want to say something, but it's really important just to witness and see it all, because you're really absorbing it and understanding it, allowing space for things to grow. And a lot of students have, because they're so curious, they want to know, they can't just witness.
That witnessing, as you describe it, sounds like a wonderful practice, because it's so easy for us to have our own ideas. Like you were just saying, there's a part of you that wants to say, oh, yes, I understand what you're feeling. And to be able to hold that, to not speak, to just, I was going to say to just, but that I shouldn't say to just, because the kind of witnessing you're talking about is not simple. And it's not about being invisible. It's actually about being very present, being very active, but not necessarily interactive.
Yeah, it's just really sitting there and observe, you know. Yeah, and how can you observe if someone is really having a really hard time, especially for a patient, you know, if they're breaking down or if they're really sharing really hard information about their personal life, and you want to reach out and, you know, give them comfort, but you're just there to observe. That is the practitioner's job. But if the practitioner is not doing that, or wanting to know, or coming from a different direction, then would you go, I wonder why is that practitioner doing that? Or perhaps there's a reason why they're doing that.
Those kind of questions are fantastic. Those are wonderful questions that you could ask your mentor after the session. You know, it's like I noticed your patient was having this strong emotional reaction and you didn't really say much. Why not? I know for myself in my practice, I want to feel like I'm connected to my patient, but I'm not necessarily there to comfort my patient.
And sometimes that's the whole point. You just want them to be independent to help themselves. You're not necessarily there to really give them that that comfort space. Well, you want them to be comfortable, but you're not really there to babysit them, I guess. Is that word I want to say? I'm sure there's a better term to use it. But yeah, it's to let them be independent with their healing journey.
there's lots of different ways to go about it. And you know, some people are very, I mean, I know practitioners, they're kind of friendly and chummy. And I know other practitioners, I wouldn't say they're standoffish or mean or anything like that, but they work with more distance. And I think so often this work is finding out what kind of practitioner we are. And that journey actually doesn't end, because whatever kind of practitioner you think you are when you first start, it'll probably be different in 5 years. And it will certainly be different 5 years after that.
Mm. I think it's important for students to know that as well, because they have all these dreams and they picture what they want to be, who they want to be, their clinic. But they also know that they should know that it changes all the time. It's that that's the only constant. And I hope that, you know, through the conversations that we have, or, you know, any other community have with Chinese medicine across the world, there'll be more students and practitioners sharing this sort of knowledge.
It used to be, I love your thought about sharing knowledge. It used to be that the way that people would share knowledge was either in a conversation or via a book. That's all we had available. And now we've got the internet. We got like a pod, you know, we have podcasts, right? There's plenty of podcasts out there. There are all kinds of social media. I mean, there's lots of different ways to share information and to, in a sense, get experience from other people. I'm curious to know, for you, besides being in a clinic with somebody, how else are you using this new internet world of ours to further your understanding of medicine? It may not be in clinic with somebody, but it is. But it's also not the usual schooling thing either.
Oh, it's amazing. I think having forums and Facebook groups. So there are a couple of Facebook groups and forums where it's only student and practitioners only. And I guess fresh new graduate would share what patients they see. And then they'll actually put the case there. And then they share their information. And practitioners will go on and talk about how you can treat better. I mean, they've been seeing this patient for a couple of while, but and they get stuck. They don't know where to go. But it's a support group where, oh, I've tried that on that patient and it really, really worked. And I've tried that too. That's that extra one thing that you could give and it absolutely works. So that's a new age of internet that I'm really thankful for, that we can find.
And you found that to be helpful?
Yeah, very helpful, because mm-hmm. that's your first protocol for support. If you're somewhere absolutely regional or rural and you have no support and you don't know who to ask, you can just jump on the internet and have this amazing support group. And they're all, you know, perhaps fresh graduates as well, the same lecturers that taught you in clinic or in university, and they're just there to support you. And it's understanding that sort of community and that network that we built, and the confidentiality as well, and the encouragement to just be vulnerable and just ask.
I've heard it said, and I think I've experienced it to be true as well, that when we are in the process of learning something, and while it is wonderful to be in the presence of someone who's been at it for 20 years longer than we have, there are things that we can learn. In some ways, that's wonderful because you get a glimpse of what a very seasoned practitioner looks like and feels like and sounds like. But it's sometimes harder to learn from those folks, because the distance between where you are as a beginner and where they are as a seasoned practitioner is quite large. Whereas if there's somebody who is maybe only 5 or 6 steps ahead of you in the process, it's often much easier to understand each other and to share ideas and actually to get help. Because in some ways, it's almost like you're speaking a similar language.
Yes, I do understand that. And I think a lot of practitioners that I know who offer mentorships are offering that because they didn't have that when they were studying. And because of that gap, they become mentors themselves after a couple of years of practice.
So here's a question I have. And this might be an unpopular question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
It's what you're good for, Michael.
Oh, boy. Yeah. So, but seriously, one of the questions I have is, how many of those people are doing mentoring because they've got a busy practice and they're looking to help someone else along? And how many are doing mentoring because they're actually not that busy doing medicine? But they're good at talking about it.
Yeah. And this is the type of talents that you ask yourself, whether are you good at talking about it? And if you don't have that busy of a practice, but does a busy practice make you a better practitioner, or does it make you a better practitioner as a lecturer or a mentor? I know one of my supervisors in clinic right now, he is very busy with his clinic. He's also teaching and he's also mentoring. And, you know, he does so much. I'm really thankful for him to be there. But I also know there are some lecturers who haven't really been in clinic for very long, but are lecturers. And some students do question, I think he should practice a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question I would have if I was a student. What's your clinical experience like? Because it seems to me, at least this has been my experience. I love learning. I love intellectual ideas. I love theories. But where the medicine actually comes alive is in the clinic. Like, is this working or not? Can I get this to work or not? This is supposed to work, but I'm failing, you know, again and again and again with what is supposed to be something that's straightforward. And I think that it's the clinic that really shows us the reality of if our ideas about things are correct or if they need some kind of calibration.
For sure. I also think that students really enjoy clinic stories. We love those clinic stories.
Everybody does.
Yeah, we do. And I think as newbies or like even my first year, you used to think about what will we see in clinic? What will we actually see?
So what are your favorite kinds of clinic stories?
I guess the really complex ones. The one that you don't know what to do after they come in for a very long time, because you see, ideally you want to see them improving. Like they maybe dip down a little bit and you see them improving, but the chart is always going up. But there's some people that just go up and then they just drop back down again. And then you ask yourself, what can I do better? What can I not do? Yeah, where am I not seeing it? And then all of a sudden, you just have a different set of eyes that come in and you know, the lecturers or the practitioner go, oh yeah, I changed that. This week, I just wanted to change that. And it worked. And they stopped coming back.
Well, one of the beautiful things about our medicine is that our failures are teachers as well. I had a teacher when I was in school who was quite experienced, and when people couldn't figure out how to help one of their patients, they would often send their patients to this guy, and he would help them. And what he said to us was, well, actually, it's not that difficult if they've already been to a couple other practitioners, because somebody tried the kidney strategy and that didn't work, and someone tried the spleen strategy and that didn't work. And someone tried the liver chi stagnation strategy and that didn't work. So it's no brilliant thing to go after the phlegm and fluids and have that work, right? Because you've already eliminated, or I should say other people have eliminated what the problem isn't. And I think our own clinical experience is a lot like this. When we have a failure, especially if you've done a very spot-on treatment, right? You see kidney insufficiency, and you treat just kidney insufficiency. And then you see what kind of response you get. If you get a good response, okay, I'm on the right track. If you don't get a good response, well, you know it's not kidney insufficiency, and depending on what the response is, maybe it lets you know what else to do. Failures are very, very helpful this way.
They are very helpful. I think one thing I ask within the clinic room is also the questioning. How does the practitioner ask the question? How do they, form their questions and words? And I think there are a lot of cultural differences as well within some practitioners. And sometimes you don't ask necessarily the right thing, or you don't question the right thing, so you're not seeing it. And I see that within some practitioners that I observe.
I think we all have blind spots. And having somebody else in our clinic can help us see that. Well, maybe we don't see it, but they do. You know, you might notice something. How come they're not asking about this thing? You know, that'd be a great question to ask your mentor. How come you didn't ask about their, about their digestion? Especially if you see a pattern. Yeah, I mean, we all get into our own little habits, and we tend to double down on the things that we know work and sometimes ignore the things that don't. But ignoring is usually not a good idea.
Yeah, and having a different pair of eyes, you just get a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, when you're mentoring with somebody, are you the only other student in the room, or are there usually other students in there as well?
Well, in our student clinic, that's where...
No, I'm talking about like when you're with a practitioner, not the student clinic, but if you're like in an externship.
Usually, I'm just the only student. Mm-hmm. Well, because I think it's COVID right now, restrictions, so you can't have too many people. But
good
when
point.
It got more relaxed, there was 4 people in the room.
So that's a lot. That's a lot of students to have in a room. Why would a practitioner want to have that many students in a room, do you think?
I think just because they're too popular. They just have too many students asking them whether I can come and observe you. And some students have more priority because, they've been there for quite some time, and some students can only do one day. And as a practitioner, if they really want to help, they allow you to be in that room. But I can see some patients shrinking as well. You go, oh my gosh, there's so many people in the room. They don't necessarily say it, but I can see it in their eyes and their body language. You know, they're kind of shrinking, go and they stick out their tongue and they're like, they don't really want to show.
I've got a friend who teaches the Sa'am acupuncture method. And when he was here in St. Louis a couple years ago, we ran an observation clinic in my clinic for a day. And I think there were, and we saw my patients, which was really fun. But it was a little bit odd for them. Instead of just seeing me, there were like 8 people in the room. And it was really funny because the teacher, he's so good with patients in general. He said, oh, so nice to meet you. We've assembled an entire team to help you today. And the patients would laugh and they would think that's great. And we're off to the races. I think, as you were mentioning earlier, the way that you express and include any students makes a big difference in how those students are included.
Definitely. In my student clinic, because I have my supervisor, and then sometimes I have a junior student, and I tell my friend, who is sometimes my patient as well, I say, you're very popular. Everybody wants to see your case. And they will laugh and they'll share more. And it's the way you kind of introduce everyone to that room as well, and make the whole environment very relaxed. And it's a room for anything to happen. Mistakes, laughter, joy, everything. But most importantly, healing and helping.
I really love that phrase, a room for anything to happen.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
I think that's what clinic is. That kind of open invitation is very inviting. How did you come? How do you come to that kind of a space for yourself that you can be comfortable with a room where anything can happen?
It's so interesting that you asked that. I think it's really through just experience, going to many, many rooms and being so used to it. Do you remember the first time you stepped into a room, a clinic room, and whether you felt nervous or anxious?
It's been a long time ago. I can conjure up an image, but I think that memory is a conglomerate of probably the first couple of months of clinic. I remember being in a room and having no idea what was going on. I'm supposed to be here to learn this stuff. I'm already trying to wrap my head around terms and ideas like stasis, wind, deficiency, excess. And now I'm in a room and trying to parse the conversation that I'm hearing into this new language that I'm learning, and being really glad that this is a 3-year program because, in the beginning, I was just dead wood.
Yeah. Same here. I remember being in a room and I go like, oh my gosh, needles. And you're like fumbling with the tube and, you're looking and you don't know what to do. And you're like placing the moxibox here. And then you have the kidney dish here and you swap here. And then you're like, but then all that, while doing all of that, you have to keep the patient comfortable as well. There's just so much going on. Yeah.
There is so much going on. Yes. Yes. Thank you for reminding me. Because at this point, I walk into a room and it's like making a cup of tea. It really is. And it's kind of fun to think back to how it used to be and how confusing it was. And even something like getting a pack of needles open the right way. I can remember watching a teacher in the beginning there, the way that he'd take a tube and the needle was there and he'd like flick it in with his thumb, like with his fingernail. He'd like flick the needle in. I remember looking at that and thinking, that's so cool. I wonder if I'm ever going to be able to do that someday.
And if you've done it, it's like nobody knows because you're in a room by yourself and you're like, oh my gosh, I did that. And the patient is like face down as well. So you're just sharing your own joy.
Things that are difficult eventually become normal, I would say. I don't know if it becomes easy, but it becomes normal.
Yeah, it's just habitual.
Over time. Yeah, you're just developing habits. Well, it sounds like you already have some useful habits. You have your witnessing. You have the sense that you can be in a room where anything can happen. That I think is a wonderful gift that you can probably bring your patients as the years unfold.
Yeah, I hope the same thing for them, to let them be comfortable in a room, because eventually that's the goal, for them to be comfortable with themselves and their bodies.
You know a good place to begin with that?
Where should I go?
You getting comfortable in the room with yourself.
Yeah, that's very true. Just being very comfortable. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it takes time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exposure. And some students just, they lack the courage to do that. If it's not for university, some of them don't even want to go for externship because they're so engrossed in the knowledge.
The knowledge is useless without the practice.
The score without the music.
The score without the music. Well, Denise, this has been an absolute delight to hang out with you. So delighted that you're here in our profession and hope, and wish the best for you with it. Do you have any other questions or thoughts about this topic of mentorship before we wind it down for today?
Not really. I'm just really thankful that you have me here and we can talk about where this goes. Perhaps maybe understand where you think. Do you have students that come to your clinic as well?
Not often. And that is because I live in a part of the country that does not have an acupuncture school. So I, on occasion, not lately, but I used to have, on occasion, students from the medical school that were interested in they had to go out sometimes and go do a day or two or something at a clinic. And they would ask to come in for a day and see what it was like to do an acupuncture clinic. And so I would sometimes have somebody from the local medical school who was going to be a Western doctor come in. And my nephew, who lives in Europe, but he's here from time to time, he is actually currently studying to be a cardiothoracic surgeon. And he's a really cool kid, very open-minded. And so whenever he's in town, he's very interested in all forms of medicine. And so he'll hang out in clinic with me, and we do pulses and tongues and, you know, look at stuff. And that's super fun hanging out with him because he brings a very inquiring mind. And then I had a high school student once who was wonderful. I think she spent 2 or 3 months in my clinic. It was part of a senior project where she really wanted to go in depth and take a look at alternative medicine. And as a high school student, she would come to my clinic, I think twice a week for like for a morning or something like that. She was really fun. You know, I mean, bringing that open, inquiring mind that you're talking about. But no, by and large, I don't have an opportunity to do that mentoring kind of work because there's just nobody here. I mean, if you'd like to come to St. Louis, Missouri, I'd love to have you in here for a bit.
That'd be really fun. Was meant to go back to the States again, but yeah, we'll see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Huanin Guanlin.
Oh, thanks for having me, Michael. This has been so delightful.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Congratulations to your 200.
For me, the deep joy of practicing this medicine is the constant and unending process of learning. This is also the greatest frustration I have with being a practitioner. The process is endless. This isn't a complaint, but it's rather a recognition that every accomplishment, every time we figure something out, more questions and unknowns will arise. It can feel like we're not getting anywhere. You know that quote from Suzuki Roshi about beginner's mind, the one that many of us love to quote, the idea that beginner's mind is delightful? But the reality that goes with it, of the ground feeling unstable beneath our feet, that is something we have to get used to as our constant companion in the practice of medicine. Sharing what we've learned with others also helps us to solidify our current understanding and help new practitioners to orient themselves toward a lifetime of learning and service. I appreciate Denise's inquisitive mind and her willingness to join me for today's conversation on medicine and how we learn, and I hope that you've enjoyed the conversation as much as I have. So this wraps up episode number 200. Again, thanks to everyone who has contributed to making Cheological what it is today. I had no idea when starting out with this little podcast experiment what might be in store. What I've heard from so many of you is that these conversations are helpful, and that certainly helps to keep some inspiration in the teacup here. And in the next few weeks, I'll be sharing more with you about some new directions with Cheological that will both bring more voices of our community to the podcast and create a structure that will allow Cheological to be here far into the future. We don't have a like button here at the podcast, but if you're inspired by the conversations here, then send me a postcard from where you listen to the podcast. That's it for today, friends. Next week, tune in for a conversation on some research where modern high-tech science meets the magic of human connection.